banking and capital markets. Learn more at lifewellplanned.com.
This is the Daily Circuit. I'm Tom Weber, along with Phil Picardi. More on Laura Ewan's report yesterday about that drowning in February of a St. Louis Park seventh grader. More analysis on from a pool safety expert. And then we'll play a conversation I moderated last night about diversity, or lack thereof, in the advertising and marketing world. That's coming up. Phil Picardi also here with regional news. Good morning, Phil.
Hi, Tom. Minnesota State University of Mankato football players are expected to return to practice this afternoon after initially refusing to play for Coach Todd Hoffner. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Players say they felt left out of the conversation and decisions about coaching changes to the team. Mavericks junior defensive back Sam Thompson says his team's refusal to play for Hoffner was meant to be a sign of solidarity for interim coach Aaron Keene. But after talking with Coach Hoffner, Thompson says the team is ready to move forward.
The players were able to make comments and ask questions to Coach Hoffner. We received the answers we were looking for, feel fit to practice, and welcome Coach Hoffner as we head toward to the end of spring drills.
Keene took over when Hoffner was arrested in 2012 and charged with child pornography. A judge later dropped those charges, and he was reinstated to the job after an arbitrator ruled the university had no grounds to fire him. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Mankato.
A teacher who spoke out for gay students during a bullying debate in the state's largest school district says he's running for a state house seat. The Pioneer Press reports Jefferson Fitek will challenge Representative Mark Uglum, a Champlin Republican. Fitek advocated for gay students in 2010 when the Anoka-Hennepin School District struggled with federal lawsuits from students who said they were bullied over real or perceived sexual orientation. Republican State Senator Julianne Ortman says her Senate campaign raised $375,000 and attracted 6,000 new donors in the first quarter of the year. That brings Ortman's fundraising total to $610,000. When it comes to campaign money, Ortman and businessman Mike McFadden lead the group of Republicans competing for the chance to run against DFL incumbent Al Franken this fall. McFadden has raised a lot more than Ortman, more than $2.8 million, but Ortman says she has momentum. Ortman says she ended March with about $250,000 and campaign cash on hand.
I am confident now that we will have all the funds we need to defeat any challenge to a primary if I'm endorsed and to defeat Al Franken in November.
Minnesota Republicans hold their convention in Rochester at the end of May. Ortman says she will abide by the endorsement, but several others, including McFadden, say they will run in the August primary with or without that endorsement. Now, for the first few minutes of the hour, we're going to look back at news about a drowning incident that happened in the Twin Cities earlier this year. In February, a seventh grade boy from St. Louis Park drowned in a middle school swimming pool in gym class. The boy, Abdullahi Sharif, was allowed to be in the pool even though he did not know how to swim. After a police investigation, the Hennepin County prosecutor has declined to press any charges. Yesterday, NPR's Laura Ewan reported on the investigation, and we thought we'd run some of the findings by National Aquatic Safety expert Tom Griffiths, who joins us from Pennsylvania this morning. Mr. Griffiths, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, let's start with Abdullahi's inability to swim. He was in the pool with a number of students who could not swim or could not swim all that well. Is it hard for a lifeguard or a supervisor, a teacher in this case, to determine just by looking if a 12-year-old or anybody else, for that matter, can or can't swim?
Extremely difficult. Most people, most supervisors, if they don't know the child, can't tell the difference between a potential Michael Phelps and a potential drownee, because drowning looks like playing often, so it's extremely difficult. And intermingling non-swimmers with swimmers in the same pool is a recipe for disaster.
Abdullahi was apparently roughhousing with a group of boys in the pool, jumping on an air mattress, shoving at each other. I've been to a number of pools. That happens all the time, doesn't it?
Well, it does happen in a recreational setting when it's guarded appropriately, but you don't want to have any large inflatable, whether it's a mat or some other flotation device in the water, with a mixed group of kids on it, non-swimmers and swimmers alike, and in deep water. Most of these inflatable devices require life jackets for all swimmers because they can fall, strike their head. They can also get trapped underneath the flotation device.
The pool was full of kids. The water was choppy. I would think it would be very hard to account for everyone. How is that on a lifeguard, or in this case, again, a teacher?
Well, even the cognitive psychologists say that lifeguarding is nearly an impossible task. If you just look at the ripple effect, the wavelets on the surface of the water, the wave action created by the other swimmers, that creates an obscuring window, just like we put on shower doors and bathroom windows, so the lifeguard or the supervisor, the teacher, can't see beneath the surface. I've dealt with dozens of these school drownings, and the child is always found after the class, before the next class, because that's when the water surface is clear and quiescent, and they can see right through it. Like a normal glass window.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what happened in this case. The teacher also was the only person supervising this class of more than 20 middle schoolers. Are there standards for how many lifeguards are needed at swimming pools?
Well, first and foremost, the standard of care throughout the country is that if you're a coach, if you're a teacher, you cannot be supervising the activity and also acting as the lifeguard. A lifeguard should have the sole duty of visual surveillance of the people in the pool. And in this case, you had a teacher who was doing teacher duties, attendance, and using an iPad and so forth, and that's a violation of the RID factor, R-I-D, the failure to recognize the victim because of intrusions and distractions placed upon the teacher. This was a perfect storm created by the school district, I believe. The non-swimmers should have been in a beginner swimming class to learn how to swim. That's the best use of a swimming pool in a school setting, is to teach all the non-swimmers how to swim first before putting them in a upper-level class or a mixed class with various abilities.
And the teacher in this circumstance also had lifeguard certification, but that certification had lapsed, and apparently the school district did not have a policy that made sure that that certification was kept up to date. So I would guess that's a problem as well.
Well, again, that's egregious. In this particular case, a separate lifeguard is needed. Non-swimmers should have life jackets. Non-swimmers should be banded or identified somehow so that they're in the shallow water only. They're never to be out in the deep water. But what happens when you put mixed ability groups in the same swimming pool? It's like downhill skiing. You'll find the weaker swimmers following their peers out into deeper water, and sometimes they'll use the sides of the pool to get out in deeper water. We've had drownings like that. In this case, the non-swimmer used the raft to get out in deep water.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about lifeguards. You know, swimming season is coming up here in Minnesota, although it looks pretty far away still. Usually they're young people who are lifeguards. Maybe they are connected with electronic devices. How hard is it for them to have total concentration on that water?
It is extremely difficult. If parents just realize how difficult it was to be a lifeguard, they probably would go to the pool with their kids themselves and watch it. Our survey of nearly 900 lifeguards worldwide admitted to texting while on duty, one in four lifeguards worldwide, even though in the aquatics industry, we have zero tolerance towards texting or having phones on duty. When we surveyed parents, close to 300 parents anonymously, they admitted to being on the phone or texting, one in five adults. Particularly adolescents who are worried about the prom and SAT tests and family matters, that's called internal noise. When they're looking with their eyes, they're not necessarily seeing because of that internal noise. So it's a real problem.
Going back to the St. Louis Park situation, when it was discovered that Abdallahi was at the bottom of the pool, the teacher did perform CPR on the boy, but he had been underwater for too long, apparently. Should there be a regular water check time when a pool is evacuated and examined?
Well, that's the protocol. The standard protocol is when you count everyone out of the water, and you should have a head count of the people getting out of the water, then you scan the bottom before you leave the pool deck. I mean, these are standard operating procedures for people guarding pools and people running pools.
So what can happen to make sure this doesn't happen again? I was kind of surprised that a pool would be in a middle school, but maybe that's because there wasn't one where I went to school. Is that a commonplace item in a pool in a school?
Sometimes you see them in middle schools. You see most of the swimming pools in schools in the high school level. I think it's a wonderful idea if we use the pool to teach non-swimmers how to swim. Ben Franklin thought that swimming should be in the schools, and in addition to reading, writing, and arithmetic, swimming was right up there. Unfortunately, school districts throughout the country, not just in Minnesota, don't use their pools wisely. They use it like they use the gymnasium as a free-for-all, but when someone faints or trips and falls in a gymnasium, they're not going to drown. Drowning is a very quick death, quick silent death, and the success rate for performing mouth-to-mouth and CPR on someone who's been submerged is very, very poor. If the child's underwater for 2 minutes or more, there's really not much of a chance bringing that person back to life.
All right. Well, Tom Griffiths, thanks for taking the time this morning to talk with us.
Thanks, and thanks for addressing such a vitally important topic.
Tom Griffiths is a national aquatic safety expert. He joined us this morning from State College in Pennsylvania. In news headlines, the captain of a sunken South Korean ferry and two other crew members could be facing prosecution. Authorities have asked a court to issue arrest warrants for the three in the disaster that may have claimed about 300 lives. The investigation into the sinking is focusing on a sharp turn the ferry took just before it began to list. A magnitude 7.2 earthquake shook central and southern Mexico today, sending panicked people into the streets where broken windows and debris fell, but there were no early reports of major damage or casualties. The U.S. Geological Survey said it was centered northwest of the Pacific resort of Acapulco, where many Mexicans are vacationing for the Easter holiday. The quake was felt strongly in that resort city. Civil protection officials are patrolling the city to check for damage and casualties. Devotees in northern Philippines had themselves nailed to wooden crosses today to reenact the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. As thousands of local and foreign spectators watched, the annual rites mark Good Friday in Asia's largest Roman Catholic nation. Today at noon, a Chautauqua lecture by Harvard political philosopher and Minneapolis native Michael Sandel. It's called What Money Can't Buy. It follows the Daily Circuit.
Programming supported by CenterPoint Energy's Home Service Plus, offering a full range of appliance services to Minnesota homeowners, from sales to maintenance and repair, providing service to Minnesotans for more than 80 years. More at hsptoday.com.
No matter how young you are or whatever your income, your good planning can make a difference. Include Minnesota Public Radio in your estate or financial plan. Learn more about options for everyone. Visit npr.org/legacy.
This is the Daily Circuit. I'm Tom Weber. Now to a conversation I moderated last night at the Illusion Theater in downtown Minneapolis about diversity in advertising. The program, the Brand Lab, works to get students from more diverse backgrounds into marketing and advertising. They hosted the event. Three industry leaders joined me: Alfredo Martel, a senior vice president at Caribou Coffee; Carla Vernon, a marketing director at General Mills; and Mike Fernandez, a corporate vice president at Cargill. I started with something I'd been noticing recently in advertisements.
I even kind of noticed this was happening before I was asked to do an event about diversity in advertising, so it was somewhere in my brain that this was happening. But with the Super Bowl recently and the Olympics in the past few months, and with, frankly, with viral videos, there does seem to be something going on with this new wave of advertising that really incorporates a new genre, a new generation, I should say, of diversity in all kinds of ways. I'm thinking Honeymaid, Coca-Cola, Chevy, Cheerios. In your estimation, and I'll start with you, Carla, is there a sea change in the content that we're seeing, or is this simply a trickle that we've had for history getting a little slightly trickle, or however that word would be?
I am glad to say that it's not a new thing. There are brands that we admire so much, like Cheerios or Coca-Cola, that have a long legacy of trying to reflect the broad face of America, the mosaic that is America. If we think back to that, if you're a Gen Xer like I am, and you think back to that beautiful Coca-Cola ad with that wonderful array of people on the hill where we wanted to teach the world to sing, that was groundbreaking at its time. And so the Cheerios ad that we're talking about, which is called Just Checking, where the daughter is in a beautiful blended family where the mom is Caucasian and the dad is African American, that shouldn't seem new anymore. But the thing with advertising is it is still, I think, a drop in the sea of what we do see in advertising. And I think that advertising is behind the times, even when compared to television or movie entertainment. So it still seems like news, even though the brave brands have known that that was a truth and a reflection of America for a long time.
Possibly, though, Alfredo, the newness, the new aspect is the degree to which we can react very quickly on social media. Maybe that's an element of what's going on here as well.
Yeah, and on the reaction to any broadcast message, I think that now we have a lot of platforms that as advertisers or as marketers, clearly you have a lot more sources of feedback to respond and react to, which it can at some times be overwhelming. And perhaps if you're a champion of diversity and to put out a social truth out there might be a little discouraging. But I think in general terms, you have to really understand that different media, different channels are suited for different things. And so I agree that an ad like Cheerios, we were commenting on this, my young children find the ad normal. They don't see anything remarkable about it. It's pretty normal. I've seen families like that all the time. Mm-hmm. Yet when you put it on mass media and a large-scale broadcast platform, there's still going to be certain aspects or sectors of the society that are going to respond to it in a way that you probably didn't really expect. So it's a much broader way for us to handle the feedback than, say, 10, 15 years ago.
You know, Mike Fernandez, you were sharing some numbers before the show, and I had seen some of those numbers as well. They're a couple years old, but I think they're still very relevant from the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor looks at all sorts of industries, and advertising came up. And simply talking about the people who work in advertising is very striking when you think about racial diversity. I know you have those numbers right there in front of you, so you should share that because this is really...
And actually, what I'm looking at now are the updated from 2013. And what was in the article was from 2011.
Okay.
But what I did that was different than what they showed in that article, because the article was pretty devastating. What the article said was that less than 1% of all advertising managers were African American in the United States today. But then when you even broaden that out to include marketing managers, to include public relations executives, when you add each of those three categories, the numbers are still relatively small. So if you want to write numbers, I'm going to give you some other numbers before I give you that. but write 21, 28, 39, and 43%. 21% are the number of ethnic and racial minorities, the percentage of racial and ethnic minorities in the United States today.
Total population.
That are silent, they're a part of the silent generation.
Yeah.
The 28% are the boomers. The 39% are the Gen Xers. And the millennials are 43% are racial and ethnic minorities. But let's go back to the agencies and even the companies combined, the managers for marketing, advertising, public relations. The percent combined for African American, Asian, and Latino is 17%. So most people talk about the sweet spot in advertising being kind of that younger audience that's, you know, 18 to 34 years of age. So essentially, most of those are millennials. And if you look at the millennials, 43% are racial and ethnic minorities. So we've got a long way to go in order to truly reflect, you know, what's happening in society. And it's interesting, you know, we were talking before we got up here, because when you get the three of us together, we can never stop. The reality is, you know, if you look at that Coca-Cola ad during the Super Bowl, and last year when we did this, we started off talking about Super Bowl ads, but if you look at that America the Beautiful ad, which I adored, I loved, I wept a tear, but there were lots of people who went on social media and really complained about the fact that it was done in seven languages. And how could you have an Arab singing America the Beautiful in Arabic? And yet, there it is. And I think the challenge for us today is that while for the three of us, you know, who have families that are either blended or we have other traditions and cultures that we grew up in and around, is it's interesting to watch how the world relates to things that some of us might clearly accept, but others clearly accept as being different and almost viewed as something to taunt them.
So, and I want to clarify here, we've talked about two different things, the diversity of the content you see on television right. or online. When you see the ad, what kind of diversity do you see? And then we've also talked about the workplaces, the advertising agencies and the companies that have these marketing departments. They kind of work in tandem together, but I do wonder, Carla, is there a guarantee that if you up that 17%, you will automatically see that reflected in more diverse advertising?
It takes two parts of the equation. We have to have people on the client side who reflect either in their values or in their life experience an appreciation for this new mosaic that we heard talked about as we talk about the evolving numbers of the generations and the browning of America. We need people on the client side who value it and demand it. And you don't have to be black or brown or Hispanic or Asian to be on the client side and demand that. One of my most profound lessons was from a Caucasian blonde female boss that I had as a marketing director who always gave me the courage to ask when a storyboard or an ad came my way if the people of color in the ad were reflected with dignity and if there were enough and if when we did the casting we used any stereotypes that are not respectful. So the client has to be courageous. The agency people need to have that same accountability. And I feel confident that if there were values, attitudes, and representative people on both sides, Tom, we would see advertising that was more reflective of it.
So there's only so much then that you're going to ever be able to do on your side of things as the ad man and the ad woman. That if the clients don't come in wanting to sell a product with an ad in it that reflects this, then that won't happen, is what you're saying.
That's right. I have to tell a story about an advertising meeting I was in. I was working on our cereal business at the time, and I was working on a children's cereal, Cocoa Puffs. It's going to be critical to the story that I tell you. It was Cocoa Puffs. And the thing about Cocoa Puffs advertising is it's animated. It's a cartoon ad. So you could put aliens in it or cuckoo birds that go cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs and cast anyone literally that you wanted. So this concept was built in a science lab. And the idea was we're going to do some testing to see how much chocolate it takes for Sunny to go cuckoo for the Cocoa Puffs. But you needed a scientist to be observing Sunny in the ad. When the storyboard came to me and the agency built it out, they put in the cast as the scientist and the scientist's apprentice a white-haired white man in a white lab coat and a younger blonde female woman in a lab coat with a notepad so that it could look like she was, you know, taking notes from her mentor. And the agency was on it was a conference call. You know, you don't do anything in person anymore. Cost savings everywhere. And so over the phone call, when we were going into the detail of how the storyboard would turn into the real ad, I said, you know, we have an opportunity in this ad to reflect in the scientist diversity. So were you on purpose putting two white people as the scientists? The agency on the other side of the phone, this will be funny because we'll see how my voice translates in radio, but the people on the other side of the phone had never met me in person, and so they didn't assume that I was African-American and Latina, which I am. They responded to me and said, well, you know, it's a short ad, it's quick, it's only 30 seconds, and we need kids to get very quickly the idea that this is a scientist. So it will register more quickly if we make sure it's a white man. To which I responded, well, that's funny because my mother is a PhD in microbiology. She's a scientist and I'm black. When that storyboard came back, the scientist was black.
It's good to be a client.
But let's not lose sight also, Alfredo. I understand. I understand on your side of that, where that's a really good opportunity to bring up. Mm-hmm. Are we making sure that this is a reflective, you know, diverse audience, or you know, in the ad? But I also wonder, you know, there is going to be that list of whatever it is I want to advertise. For which, if I'm running that business, it doesn't mean I'm a bad person, but do I really care if my ad for, you know, an air conditioning unit is really, if we really hammer into those kinds of details ad nauseum?
Right. Well, I think that the reality of business and the reality of advertising, it's a for-profit endeavor. And I think that actually at the opening remarks, Ellen mentioned it makes good business sense to really make sure that you're addressing your audience and the audience that's actually the real target for your product. In our roles, we have to be very cognizant of the fact that while we have to manage things like brand identity and standards for the brand, at the end of the day, we're trying to sell a product to a consumer. And you have many platforms in which you can do that. You can do TV ads, you can do digital media, social, etc. And so there's an opportunity to do broad-based messaging that is encompassing of the diversity, that the mosaic, as Carla refers to, and I love that word, is in reality. But then there's the second tier, we were talking, where you can actually micro-message very specifically to specific groups, diverse groups, groups that might actually have nothing to do with each other. And that's a second challenge right there, because if a brand is trying to talk to Hispanics, Hispanics is a big word. There's Mexicans, there's Costa Ricans, there's Puerto Ricans, there's Cubanos. There's,
don't forget the Panamanians.
No te olvides lo panameño. And who can forget the Venezuelans, who are going through a rough patch right now. And so even when you take a slice and say, we're gonna use this particular micro strategy to talk to Hispanics, you can make mistakes even in a slice like that if you don't really understand insights, if you don't understand the truth of that demographic or of that identity. But I think that the story that Carla was sharing with us and the story about the big ads, it's about American identity and really sort of somewhat reflecting it, but also challenging what is the identity of America. Because I think, to your point, the singing of America the Beautiful was the thing that was the irking element, not whether it was in Spanish, in Arabic, or Chinese, or whatever. So the identity of a big collective, and at the same time, the identity of that group that identifies itself as, in my case, I'll say, Los Boricuas, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of really interesting challenges for a marketer and for ad agencies to harness the talent necessary to navigate mm-hmm. these complex waters, because it's not going to get any simpler. It's going to continue to get more complex.
I also want to clarify the micro strategies you're talking about, ways to use things like Twitter or advertise on a specific network versus the Super Bowl ad that everyone in the country
absolutely
sees. So if Mike Fernandez, we look at the stats you just gave us about, especially in the workplace and advertising and marketing, about how it doesn't reflect the census figures, basically. Yeah. You could say that crisis exists in any number of industries.
Sure.
Why should we give any more attention to advertising and marketing than we give to insert industry name here?
Well, and I think ultimately it matters in terms of what do people see and perceive. You know, whether they're watching something on air or they're reading something on the internet, we're talking about how people's mind's eye is shaped by the things that they see and come in contact with every day. There's a big issue today in the fashion industry about the lack of diversity. And it was funny because I was actually reading a story in a magazine this morning, and then I went on and it was about the lack of diversity in fashion. And then I start looking through all of the advertising in the New York Times today for all of the department store ads, all the clothing ads, and even in the fashion section, because there's a fashion section in the Thursday newspaper. Not that I normally look at it, but because I had read that article, I was like keenly sensitive to say, well, let me just see out of curiosity. And there was a total lack of diversity.
May I add something? May I build on top of it?
Colin.
You know, Gina Davis founded the Gina Davis Institute that does some of the leading research on the role of gender in media, and I really encourage people to visit her website. She's a real thought leader and does some major pieces of research with some universities and institutions. And the reason it matters is because she has research that demonstrates the lack of representation of female characters in everything from children's programming to major popular movies to television has a direct correlation to the attitudes that children grow up with about
Absolutely.
What they believe they are capable of doing and what they believe is appropriate according to gender. So boys are learning and girls are learning based on these forms of entertainment that, as Mike said so well, our mind's eye sees and they create our perception of how we then actually build the communities that we build. I am convinced that thanks to Will and Grace, we believed that same-sex couples and people who make a life choice that way, that is a person that could be our neighbor, our friend, that we could care for, that we could weep with, that we could love, and that having a black president on 24 allowed America to imagine a vision where they could entrust a leader who would be African American. Our forms of media teach us about what we can be as a people in America.
So you just cited two television shows that gave us a vision of how we can view things. Do you have an advertising example? That ad where this thing happened showed America that...
I am loving that if what I think you were trying to possibly question in the beginning was, are we at an advent where advertisers are getting courageous to reflect this mosaic? And we are seeing in the Honeymaid ad, they project various versions of family and really call to question, what do we consider wholesome in America? Is a two-dad family raising a baby wholesome? Is a single dad raising a son wholesome? Is a guy all tatted up with his Generation X tattoos, is he allowed to be a wholesome dad? And at the same time, we see the Swiffer ads where these boxes of Swiffers are just trying to help make families' lives easier, and we see a mixed-race couple with a guy with a physical handicap. And so I do think advertisers are doing some of the work to normalize some things, but the medium of advertising is about selling a product. So its main job, if it's doing what it's doing right, is to sell more next year of the same thing it tried to sell last year.
That was Carla Vernon from General Mills, part of a discussion I moderated last night on diversity in advertising and marketing. We'll return to that conversation after a check of this hour's news with Phil Picardi. Hi, Phil.
Tom, Ukraine's interim government may be willing to meet some of the demands of pro-Russian protesters who continue to hold government buildings in eastern Ukraine. A statement from the country's acting president and prime minister says the government is ready to enact constitutional reforms that will give Ukraine's regions a greater say in local governance. The protesters are refusing to give up control of the buildings, say they want the interim government to resign first. They were supposed to leave the occupied buildings under an agreement reached in Geneva yesterday by Russia, Ukraine, the U.S., and the European Union. He was able to escape a sinking ferry, but more than 200 of his students were not as fortunate. And now a high school vice principal in South Korea has apparently taken his own life. He left behind a note saying he could not bear the guilt of surviving the disaster while so many of his students were lost. Family members and friends of the police officer authorities say was killed by the Boston Marathon bombing suspects are honoring him a year later. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where Sean Collier worked and died, held a remembrance ceremony for him today. And NASA's moon-orbiting spacecraft LOTI is no more. Flight controllers confirm it crashed into the backside of the moon. The Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer completed its mission last month. More ahead on the Daily Circuit.
What makes Minnesota Public Radio News different? A robust regional newsroom covering the state.
Man has a wonderful track record of wrecking stuff. And if we do that to water, we're really in trouble.
Coverage you can trust, presented with integrity.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel.
Hi, I'm Kathy Worzer.
Hi, it's Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition.
The difference is financial support from listeners like you. Learn more at minnesotapublicradio.org.
Support for this program comes from the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux Community, one of 11 federally recognized tribes in Minnesota. Like states, each tribe has its own government. Tribes are more than an ethnic group. Their sovereignty is recognized in the U.S. Constitution.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, the power behind your electric cooperative.
This is the Daily Circuit. I'm Tom Weber. Let's get back to the discussion I moderated last night at the Illusion Theater in Minneapolis. It was the latest Fearless Conversation from the Brand Lab. That's an educational program for diverse students in marketing and advertising. I was speaking with Alfredo Martel from Caribou Coffee, Carla Vernon from General Mills, and Mike Fernandez from Cargill, and I asked them about some research I had read recently.
There's a professor at the University of Illinois named Jason Chambers who studies this. He wrote a book called Madison Avenue and the Color Line, and he paraphrases one of the lines from his book, and this gets to some of the tension on whether you do this ad or not. And he says, the businessman doesn't want to antagonize anybody, even the bigots. I'm curious, Carla, if that is still the prevailing sentiment. Mike, do you have a thought?
No. I mean, we are seeing some people who are trying to purposely, I think, be disruptive. And I think that's a good thing, that you have some advertisers out there that are saying, okay, we're going to poke the public a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because in poking the public, and we were talking a little bit about the Honeymaid ad earlier, is that, you know, in part, the category that that product exists in is almost commoditized. Yet, by doing this very distinguished ad that kind of stretches for some Americans the notion of what a family is, creates almost a little nervous jitter at the end of that that prompts people to talk about Honeymaid. So it's fascinating. In fact, you know, you almost wonder, you know, with the Coca-Cola ad, with America the Beautiful, you know, while I got all teary-eyed about it, you almost wonder if there wasn't even half a thought, maybe, that there might be some backlash and that that might be a good thing, because then people were talking about the ad.
I would add,
sorry. I just want to say, that line from Jason Chambers' book wasn't his opinion. He was writing to explain some of the phenomenon. Right. I just want to clarify that.
It said businessman. That's where you lost me. It started out
businessman.
Business entity.
Yeah. We've talked a lot about the content we see on television. And as we've alluded to, the idea that that the three of you, I know, all agree, there need to be changes within these companies that bring us this content. And Carla, you were saying something interesting before this conversation about the concept of mentoring.
Yes.
Which I thought was very interesting.
Yes.
And this idea that if you're a person of color and you make it into this industry that is so not diverse, that you need to have a mentor, and what's happening?
Well, I am observing a generational shift that I think comes from great things that give us paint a hopeful future, but could be problematic as it relates to people's careers. And so I'm seeing that the younger generation of people coming into my company, the diverse ones, the African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Hispanics, the younger employees might not be as proactive in seeking and engaging with mentors who are more senior in the company. In my generation, it was considered a really critical piece of establishing your relationship so you could kind of learn what it takes to get ahead and how's the right way to make yourself a success. And
And the new generation doesn't seem to be as eager to engage in that. And I believe it stems from their worldview that says, I don't want to be judged, right? Dr. King said, I don't want my children judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. So I celebrate that that's the space these young people are coming from. The challenge that I see is that as you look in many of these companies that are profit-centered, the leadership, the shape of leadership is like a pyramid, right? Wide at the bottom and narrows as you get to the top. It's more than a pyramid. It's almost like a mountain. The air gets thinner as you get to the top, too. And so it becomes critical to have people who can help you decode. As you continue to try to ascend and those opportunities get more limited, you need someone who can help you decode what it takes to get ahead. And so I'm concerned if our young people are unaware that some of those things that make it at the exclusive levels at the top, that make it difficult to break in at those exclusive levels, are still at play, even as much as the mainstream mosaic is changing colors. The dynamics inside of corporations for career ascension is still decades behind, and it's the same pattern and the same game and the same steps as it always was.
So what would a mentor, what did your mentor help you, you know, decode?
Yeah. My mentor told me, if you want to get to the senior levels of a company, even a wonderful modern company like General Mills that's very value-centered, you have to recognize that it's like an exclusive club at the top. Or you could think of it as a luxury car. And some people already have keys to the car. That car is really special and valuable, and that's that those executive seats. And they don't want anybody to take that car and drive it and mess up the engine or crash the car or ruin the reputation of the company or lead us financially down the wrong path. And so they need to be certain that who they hand the keys to the car to is somebody who knows how to take care of and respect the equipment. So you need to assure the people at the top that when they give you the keys, you will treat the car right.
When did General Mills start selling cars? I'm joking, of course.
So, you know, they just are teaching you that you don't make the rules. The rules are still made by the people who give you the access. And so you need to understand what their expectations are.
I'll add to the Alfredo? To the commentary on mentorship. I'm 48, and I enjoyed many great mentors in my career, and I seek them out. The one thing that is, in my experience, my truth, is I never seeked out a Hispanic mentor. I sort of quickly understood how the mountain and the air gets thin up there, and I always seeked out Mario, who's a VP of Hispanic marketing, will be your mentor. No, I wanted the mentor who was in the mainstream, in the club, and I would be sort of his, well, this one over here is a little different, but we'll mentor him as well. And so my truth was that I seeked out to understand how I could progress my career, but I seeked out from a general market or a general perspective. It's my experience, and now I do it the opposite way. I obviously am very open in how I help our young people at Caribou or whoever actually links in with me. I never say no to anybody, so my LinkedIn list is a mess. But
and I'm older than both of them, so as a consequence, the air was really super thin.
Yeah.
And there weren't anybody there with a Z or a vowel at the end of their name to help me along. But that said, I think that the lesson that we should take away from this conversation, whether you're managing an agency or you're managing a large company, is that probably what we have to do to bring that next generation along is take a lesson from some other progressive companies that are actually doing reverse mentorship, where they're actually going to these millennials and saying, you know, we don't know that much about the internet. We don't know that much about the changes that are taking place across America. Maybe you can teach me a little bit more about that mosaic. You can teach me a little bit more about what's happening in social media. And I think then we'll see the change.
A few years ago, the NAACP started an effort called the Madison Avenue Project, which was basically aimed at improving hiring and promotion and retention of minority professionals. And they talk specifically about the advertising industry. I'm curious, Alfredo, is the issue, is the problem, is the bottleneck that there aren't enough applicants of color to better diversify these workforces? Or is the hiring system within these agencies and companies still maybe too much of a buddy system?
Well, as you know, the mission of the Brand Lab is to create as large a pipeline of candidates for the industry as possible by giving them access to the industry. So one, there's that effort to try and bring exposure to the industry to as many potential employees from these minority groups. I think the second part, and it comes to then the environment in the industry and how does the industry reshape itself to retain the talent that they acquire? And I think that goes a much longer way to just simply saying, well, we're hiring, but they're not staying. Mm-hmm. Well, the question is why they're not staying. What is it in the environment that it's not conducive to that retention? And I think that's a lot harder work and a lot more reflection. And frankly, I'm kind of very excited to hear from the audience because I think that's the crux of where the steps to be addressed are in terms of what is it that once you're inside of the four walls of the industry, why is it that we're not retaining and having that talent thrive? Why is it sort of falling through our fingers or slipping through our fingers?
You know, the creator of Mad Men has gotten some pushback. That show obviously had to come up at some point in the conversation. For that show, based in the 60s, not having a lot of people of color within those episodes, and the creator says, look, John Hamm's character would have never interacted with an African American. Why would I fake that and put that in the TV show? Is what you see on Mad Men any different today inside the advertising agencies and the companies today?
Good question.
Yeah.
When I ask the women account executives who have worked with my brand teams, because I work with some of the most talented female advertising executives, and every time one of those brilliant women goes off and has her baby and then comes back and tries to have the job and then she's somehow transitioned off and I never see her again except on Facebook, I ask them, what's going on? Why can't you guys, what's the problem? And they say it is startlingly like Mad Men, and they don't even want to tell me about it.
Wow. So Mad Men could be set in the 2000s.
It's troubling. And is it Matthew Weiner is the creator of Mad Men?
Mm-hmm.
The other interesting thing, because there is an interview where he's doing, I think for the museum, where he's talking about that perspective, is he said he's never heard a black person talk to him about the lack of black people on Mad Men because the black people respect his honesty. And he is actually allowing us to see our honest, painful history. That those couple black secretaries on the show were the best we got. That was the closest shot we got. And even Joan's journey on the show is a pretty ugly one. But women had to get in the game however they could, and we don't like looking at it, but he is being honest.
We'll have some questions here from the audience.
Hello, my name is Vanessa. I work at Weber Shandwick. I was born and raised in Minnesota, African American, and one of the things that I was always taught is you can't do 100% to get ahead. As an African American, you got to give 150%. You got to do better than the next man. But as soon as you do that, you have your peers who are ready, and they're not the same as you, ready to tear you down, or they're intimidated. How do you get past that?
Thoughts, Alfredo?
I never got past that, and in my truth, in my journey, I kept going. And yeah, at first it was probably tough, but I found that my mentor, who was not Hispanic, said to me, you know, and this is a business, I was in Louisville, Kentucky, And you know what I'm talking about, right? He said, listen, you're the drum beat. You're the energy guy. This floor with you in it is alive. This floor, when you're having a bad day, we all have a bad day. That's what you do to this organization with your, call it, Latino, Hispanic energy. He said to me one very simple thing. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise that you don't have to do that. You bring our energy. And he said to me, if you're going to have a bad day, have your bad day at home. Don't let anybody ever see you not on. And that was very good advice because I thought that I had to, all right, maybe I need to tone it down and let's start giving 80% to sort of go with a bell curve, right? And he gave me the complete opposite advice. He said, nope, that's you. I remember he said, do what you do and don't let anybody tell you any different. And it was great advice from a non-ethnic mentor who could have said, hey, you know, the nail that stands up gets hammered down. He gave me the complete opposite advice. So my reaction to your question is, do what you do. It's a meritocracy, and it's a for-profit business.
I think we have time for one final question up to the left there.
Hi, my name is Brandon Boat, and you already touched on this a little bit, and I was hoping you could expound some more on it. Do you feel that it's a better course of action to have people folded into existing agencies and models of business, or that they should go out and create their own agencies that will serve and meet the needs of these communities directly rather than kind of going with the way that business has always been done and inserting themselves there?
The agency model is consolidating, so this is a really difficult challenge, I think, for the brown voices, the Asian voices, the Native voices. I think it's going to be tough. But what I have seen that's troubling is that I love some of the wonderful work from my Hispanic agencies and my African-American agencies, but when they try to survive on their own, they're often getting the scraps on the table after the general market campaign. So the business model is very tough. For our agencies that specialize in ethnic campaigns. I don't know what you guys think.
Why is the African-American agency or the Latino agency have to fight for 10% of Pepsi's budget? Why don't they get smart and go for the whole budget? That's the question.
Well, and I also think that, again, numbers don't lie. And given the fact that there are vast changes happening in the marketplace, I think we're going to see a marketplace where you do have a few Latino or African-American agencies persist. I also think we'll continue to see the trend where some will get gobbled up by larger entities. I think at the end of the day, I don't know that I'd be too worried about either trend. Instead, I would be worried more about the marketplace to be served. Because I think no matter who you are, whether you're Anglo, whether you're Latino, whether you're African-American or Asian, the reality is that America is changing. And it's changing in vast and very quick ways. Part of that is that we're becoming more diverse. Part of it is that we're more social, and it's not just social media, but there's a certain expectation that has been created in the marketplace that people are going to have a relationship with their brands, and they expect us to answer when they pose questions. There's also a world that's 24/7. There's no longer a news cycle. It's immediate. It's constant. On top of that, there's a sense that people are looking at the world through contextual eyes, in the sense that all of us bring different experiences, different backgrounds to the game, both as creatives as well as observers of what's going on in society. This is going to prompt all of us to have to sort of broaden our horizons, look out at that mosaic, and say, how do I really capture the essence of this particular brand or this particular product or service in order to sell more, for more, to more in the future? That's going to require all of us to be stretched in ways that we haven't been stretched before.
That was Mike Fernandez from Cargill. You also heard Carla Vernon from General Mills and Alfredo Martel from Caribou Coffee. They joined me last night in a panel discussion that explored diversity in advertising. hope you'll consider coming out to the University of St. Thomas on May 1st for the Broadcast Journalist Series. I'll be speaking with Melissa Block. You hear her every day on All Things Considered during the afternoon. There's more information at npr.org/tickets. And be sure to tune into the Daily Circuit on Monday. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, as always, he'll be joining us.
Programming is supported by the Minnesota AIDS Walk, Sunday, May 18th. By participating in the Minnesota AIDS Walk, you can help prevent HIV and support the HIV community. Registration online at mnaidswalk.org.
You're listening to listener-supported Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis and St. Paul. You can download our new and improved mobile apps for iPhone and for Android. It's 45 degrees right now, sunny skies, beautiful lunch hour here,